We are in John chapter 18. And you can go ahead and open up your Bibles to that passage. It's going to start on page 904 in your house Bible. And we are going to read about this pretty famous dialogue. Dialogue first between the Jewish leaders and Pontius Pilate, and then Pontius Pilate and Jesus himself. And of course, as Travis mentioned, the famous line in there, the famous question that Pilate asks is a simple three-word question: what is truth? And with that simple question, Pilate opens up a conversation for us, a conversation about the nature of truth. What is truth? And that's what we're going to try to tackle this morning. So let's go ahead and read our passage. It's John 18, verses 28 through 40. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to him, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." The Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, "I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" They cried out again, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. So we're tackling this idea of truth, the nature of truth. And the first thing that I want to mention is that truth is a huge topic, of course, in the Bible and the New Testament, but especially in the writings of John. John really emphasizes this idea of truth. Let me give you a few examples here. First of all, of the 97 times that the word truth is used in the New Testament, 46 appear in John's writings. For the word true, 40 out of 66 are in John's writings. And so John really wanted to take this idea and emphasize it. You know, each of the gospel writers or the New Testament writers, they are inspired by the Holy Spirit. God moves in their words and what they write, and yet they all had a perspective, and so they write what they felt like was important to get across to their audience, and John feels that it's really important to talk about truth. John describes Jesus as coming in grace and truth. He really opens his gospel in that way. Jesus came full of grace and truth. When Jesus was speaking to the woman at the well in Samaria in chapter 4, said that true worshipers are to worship in spirit and in truth. Jesus, of course, in John 14 described himself this way: "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Of course, in these last few chapters that we've been reading, Jesus says how he will send the Spirit. And how does he describe the Holy Spirit here in these chapters? Describes him as the Spirit of truth. Jesus prayed for his disciples that they would be sanctified in truth. And finally, in what we just read, this is how Jesus describes his purpose. He says, "This is why I came, to bear witness to the truth." Now, of course, Jesus' mission, his purpose, could be described in a lot of different ways. It's very multifaceted. He came because he loved the world. He came to save us. He came to obey his Father and to show his love for his Father. All those things are true. Those are part of Jesus' purpose. But it could also be described as to bear witness to the truth. That's why Jesus came to this world. Truth is very important, of course, to Jesus and definitely in John's gospel. And so we come to this passage right here, and the topic is truth. And Pilate asks his famous question, what is truth? And so we want to try to tease that out and try to understand what Jesus means by truth. But what we're going to see in this passage, actually, is a contrast. And as we see these dialogues with the Jewish leaders and with Pilate himself, we see approaches to truth that were off target. The Jewish leaders seem to approach truth in a particular way, but it didn't lead them to where they needed to be. And Pilate, representing Rome, approaches truth in a certain way, but that did not lead him where he needed to be either. And so what I'd first like to do is to take a look at each of those approaches to truth that we see in this passage, first from the Jewish leaders and then from Pilate. And so we'll read a few of the statements they made or the actions that they took and try to get an idea of how these different people or groups of people were approaching truth. So first, the Jewish leaders. Let's read verse 28 again. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. Okay, so they didn't enter Pilate's headquarters. What does this tell us about their perspective on truth? Well, first of all, we just see that at this time, the Jewish people were not willing to associate with Gentiles, non-Jews. In fact, it was unlawful for them to do so. They could not enter a building. They could talk to a Gentile, say outside or in some sort of a courtyard, but if there was a roof, they were not to go underneath that roof with a Gentile. If they did, they would be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. And of course, it was the beginning of the Passover, this week-long celebration, and so they did not want to be ceremonially unclean, and so they would not go under Pilate's roof. Now, we see the same thing in other places in the New Testament. We see it even from Peter later on in the book of Acts. Let's read Acts 10, verse 28. And this is after God moves Peter through a vision to go to this city, Caesarea, which was primarily Gentile, and he was to go to the house of this Gentile named Cornelius. And here's what happens in verse 28. And he said to them, Peter said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean. So Peter is acting underneath the same sort of standard or law. He believed that he, as a good Jew, was not to associate with a Gentile. And he tells Cornelius that. I actually shouldn't be here. The problem was, although this was what was lawful for a Jew, this was not God's law. You actually don't find this kind of prohibition in the Old Testament. Now, certainly, God was setting apart the Jewish people for a specific reason. And he wanted certain standards, and he wanted to keep them distinct in different ways, but he does not take it to this level of prohibiting even entering the house of a Gentile in the Old Testament. This actually came out of the hundreds of years of Jewish tradition that was added since the last Old Testament prophet. And so they had expanded these ideas. Now, again, as I just said, God did want to make the Jewish people distinct, but he had a greater purpose for that distinction. We remember the original promise to Abraham. God came to Abraham and said, I am going to bless you and your descendants, but I'm going to do it in order to bless the entire world. Abraham would receive a special, unique, exclusive blessing, but that exclusiveness was for the sake of inclusiveness. It was going to bless the entire world. Now, it seems like at this point, many of the Jewish leaders had embraced part of God's intention here in making the Jewish people very set apart and distinct, but they had forgotten what the ultimate purpose for that distinction was. And so they were not even going under the roof of a Gentile. It's like they had taken a piece of truth, a half-truth, divorced it from the whole truth, and then exaggerated that half-truth. Yeah, that's what they were doing. And then we see how it plays out, and we see how it plays out in the life of Jesus. I want to read this passage from early on in Jesus' ministry in Luke chapter 4. And I think this also illustrates some of the mentality that had been adopted by the Jewish nation at this point in time. So Jesus had begun his ministry and had begun to work all kinds of miracles and to teach, and he was doing amazing things. He returns to his hometown in Luke chapter 4. And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here in your hometown as well.' And he said, 'Truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. But in truth, I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and a great famine came over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up and drove him out of the town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built so that they could throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away." It's really interesting. Jesus, the people attempt to kill Jesus very early on here. Now he eludes them and just walks through the crowd, but they were so enraged that they wanted to kill him. Why were they so enraged? Well, he was doing all these amazing things, and when he returned home, they expected he will do even more amazing things for us because we grew up with him. But Jesus comes and he says these sort of edgy things, and he points out these situations from the Old Testament, and he said, "You remember that in these cases, God worked in powerful ways, not just for your nation, but actually he worked in unique ways for these Gentiles." And they were enraged by it. They're absolutely enraged. And they tried to kill him. They drove him to the edge of a cliff, intending to throw him off of it, even though they knew him. He had grown up in their town. Similarly, we could go to the end of Acts, in Acts chapter 22. Paul comes to Jerusalem, and everybody's really upset with him, and they arrest him, and they want to do away with him. He asks to speak to the crowds, and so he does speak to the crowd, and he starts speaking to them in Aramaic, their language, and they calm down and begin to listen to him, and he tells his long story about how God came to him, Jesus came to him, and he tells this story, and they are listening to him attentively until the end. He says this, he's describing what Jesus told him, "And he, Jesus, said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.' Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live.'" Again, incredible rage. Why? Because he was claiming that Jesus said, "Go to the Gentiles." And that did not fit in their version of truth. Remember, they had taken that half-truth. They were distinct. They were set apart. They were holy people. And they had divorced that from the ultimate purpose of their set-apartness and then exaggerated it. And so they could not receive this. They just couldn't. And so they tried to kill Jesus. They tried to kill Paul. And at the trial of Jesus, they would not even go underneath the roof of Pilate. And so what do we see here? Well, I think we see the Jewish leaders manipulated truth or used half-truths for self-serving sectarian purposes. Again, they were drawing a circle around themselves. They said, "We should be elevated and exalted." And that became their ultimate goal. And we're going to use pieces of truth to promote that end goal as best we can. And we can keep reading and see how this played out in different ways. Let's now read verses 29 and 30 again. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." What a pathetic response. So Pilate comes out, and I mean, this is kind of reasonable. It's a reasonable question. He says, "Well, what did he do? Tell me what he did." You say, "Well, we wouldn't have brought him here if he didn't do something." And so they do not appeal to any kind of evidence, rationale, truth. Rather, they are just being big and forceful. And they say, "Well, we wouldn't have brought him here. Of course there's something wrong. It's so obvious, we don't even have to say it." That's what they're saying. So the Jewish leaders use pressure and emotionalism rather than objective facts here, because they had to defend the way that they saw the truth. A couple verses later, verse 31, the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." And this is very interesting also. So they're pressuring Pilate here. This says, "Well, we're not supposed to do this." So they were kind of obeying the law here, what they saw the law to be, but they were still going to make it happen. Okay, they weren't going to directly do the deed, but they were going to do everything in their power to make it happen indirectly. And so what we see is the Jewish leaders generally obeyed the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. Okay, they were going to try really hard to honor the law or the truth, the objective truth, but really, they had different intentions. They were going to give appearances of honoring the truth, but they were not. It was really interesting. So again, the Jewish people at this time, they were the ones that had been selected by God. They had been given the Torah, the Bible, and they were the people of the book. They were the ones that could have a claim on objective truth from God. But we see that they just took pieces of that and manipulated it, and they weren't really submitting to that overarching objective truth from God. It was really just lip service. So that was them. We're going to summarize that in a minute. But let's go to Pilate now, and let's look at his approach to truth. And we'll start again in verse 31, the first part of verse 31. Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." Okay, just you deal with it, is what he's saying. Now, this is somewhat understandable. You know, Pilate was probably in town here because it was the Passover, and there was a strong likelihood that this, you know, at these kinds of gatherings and celebrations, this nationalistic sentiment would rise, and there could be a lot of fervor, and there could be uprisings. And so he was there to just sort of quell any of that kind of thing, as it was likely to happen. And it was starting to happen. And so he just doesn't want to deal with it. He says, "Guys, you take care of your own issue." And so it's sort of understandable, but I think we see something here that Pilate did not appeal to an overarching standard. There wasn't something transcendent that was over everybody, but it preferred to have individual groups deal with issues themselves. He said, you guys just take it. Because I don't think there was this firm, this is justice, this is not justice, this is truth, this is not truth, standard that he could fall back on. And so he just wants to get it out off of his desk. Next, we could go to verse 33. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Now, what's he asking here? I think he was trying to discover, is Jesus really a threat? Is he really this insurrectionist that's going to cause all these kinds of issues for me? Who is he? I think Jesus surprised him. Jesus was not presenting himself as the belligerent rebel that Pilate probably expected and that Pilate was used to dealing with. Instead, Jesus was pretty in control, and he was calm and peaceful, and he wasn't just scrambling to defend himself. This was different. But Pilate is asking, are you the king of the Jews? Again, he's trying to understand, is this something I really need to deal with or not? Who is Jesus claiming to be? And so what I think we see here is that Pilate was a pragmatist. He wasn't interested primarily in justice, but stability. He just wanted to keep the peace. He didn't want a headache. He wasn't going back to and appealing to some standard of justice. No, he just wanted to, let's make things quiet. That's what we do as parents a lot of the time. Just make it quiet. That's what Pilate was doing. So we get a little bit of a flavor of how Pilate was operating. But then comes his famous question in verse 38. Jesus was describing certain things, and Jesus makes these bold statements about how he came to bear witness to the truth, and that's what he was all about. His kingdom's not of this world, but he came to bear witness to the truth of the next world. And then Pilate responds in this way. What is truth? We don't know exactly how he said it, but you sure get the impression he's just sort of dismissive. Truth. What's that? Is there any such thing? And he asked the question, and it's so ironic, obviously. Pilate is asking this question, what is truth, to the truth? The truth is standing right in front of him in the form of a man. And he's asking this question, what is truth? And after he asks the question, it doesn't seem like he waited for a response, and he turns around and he goes back outside to the Jews, talks to them some more. Now, what do we see here? Well, of course, we see that Pilate didn't see truth as knowable or even real. This was his approach to truth. This may have been the Roman approach to truth at the time. What's truth? Probably nothing. He just dismisses truth. Now, we'll camp here a little bit because this is so familiar. You know, if you look around, you'll hear that question asked all the time. Dismissively, what is truth? This is much of how our world operates. What is truth? And when there's a dismissal of truth, here's the turn, is it always turns inward. Okay, if there's no overarching transcendent truth that governs everything, then I'm left on my own to discover my own truth. You know, in 2018, Oprah Winfrey gave a very impassioned, inspiring speech at the Golden Globe Awards. And one of the famous lines that she spoke was this. She said, speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. Speaking your truth. And you hear that kind of phrasing a lot. Speaking your truth. Your truth. It's everywhere in some form, one form or another. It's about my truth. There's been this inward turn. I discover or even produce truth myself, and so I should speak my truth. And again, this is everywhere. You know, I like to look for examples of this, and I collect them. And I've shown some of them here before. I'll just show one more that I just came across recently, and because I just to illustrate just how this way of approaching truth is everywhere in our world, this inward turn to discover my own truth. So my kids are taking some online classes, and those of you that are taking online classes or have kids who are taking online classes, you understand that there are these online tools that are really administrative tools that let you access things that you need for those classes. So you can see your assignments, or you can see your grades, or you know, your syllabus from your class, or something like that. And so you go online and you access this information. It's just an administrative tool for your classes. And you would think, in a purely administrative tool, there would not be any kind of philosophical trappings there. There wouldn't be values that come across, but not in today's world. Of course, there are going to be values that come across. And so so I'll just show you a couple screenshots. You get into this tool, and right away, they have values, like core values, again, for this purely administrative tool. And specifically in this particular one, for these classes, there are 5 C's. Okay, 5 values that start with the letter C. And I'll just share 2 of them. The first one is creativity. And here's what it says. There isn't one right answer in the dreamscape, and you're here to discover new answers. At times, it may seem like a problem is unsolvable. When that feeling arises, get creative. You have a unique mind that will always find a way. And then I want to go to the next C, second value, and that is critical thinking. And how they define critical thinking, here it is. As you learn, you will experience and uncover many new ideas. We are not here to tell you to think, feel, and dream for the same things we do. We want you to be uniquely you. That means as you learn, you'll have to decide what resonates with you the most. You get to evaluate and form your own opinions as you gain perspective through your experiences. Now, it's relatively benign, you could say. This is a lot of the language that we swim in. You know, it's not a huge deal, but I bring it up just because I think even in places that you might not expect it, there is language, there are values that are basically saying, what is truth? And look inside. Discover your own truth. That's actually what critical thinking is today. Discovering your own truth. It's a very common approach to truth in our world today. So, to summarize these two approaches, let's do that. I would say there are two common approaches to truth that we see in the Jews and in Pilate. One is to outwardly demonstrate a respect for objective truth, but actually manipulate truth for self-serving ends. And I think that's what the Jewish leaders were doing. They were giving lip service to objective truth, but not really. Really, they were taking that so-called objective truth and they were submitting it to their own sectarian purposes. That's what they were doing. And the second approach is to dismiss objective truth outrightly and then give all authority to the individual. And this is what Pilate and Rome were doing. Okay, and these are the approaches. And really, we see both of these all over the place in different ways. Okay, you could say one is more towards the ideological right and one more towards the ideological left. We see them all around us. But the thing is this. Both end up in the same place. Okay, they both end up in the same place because at their root, they're both denying objective truth and they're making it about themselves. That's what they're both doing. And so they both end up in the same place and they converge together to kill the Son of God. And that's what they do. But there is a different way. Okay, there is a real truth. And so let's try to describe that real truth that Jesus is alluding to. First of all, let me just give us a few ideas that I think help define how the Bible speaks about truth. Okay, so biblical truth is, number one, not false. Okay, so this is our common understanding of truth, of course. It's not a lie. It's not false. It's true. Okay, so we all understand that. It's not false. But let's try to expand on this biblical definition of truth. Number two, I would say biblical truth is moral excellence. I'll read Romans 2:8 for you. But for those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, there will be wrath and fury. Now, this is interesting because there's a contrast, there's a juxtaposition here of truth and unrighteousness. You either obey truth or you obey unrighteousness. And it just sort of demonstrates that, okay, in this sense, truth is about righteousness. It's about moral excellence. It's about what's good. So that's another piece of the definition of biblical truth. Three, we could say what's authentic and ultimate. You know, Jesus, even in the book of John here, speaks of true things quite a bit. So he speaks of true bread. He's the true bread, the true vine, true worshipers, true riches, the true king. And what's he getting at here? Well, he's saying that these are the authentic things, and really the ultimate, the source, the genuine one. When he speaks of himself being the true bread, he's saying, well, bread in general is one thing, but bread is all pointing to this ultimate sustenance. Okay, it's what's genuine, it's what's real, what's the source of everything. And then fourthly, truth is about being faithful and trustworthy. You know, one of the last titles that Jesus takes in the New Testament is in Revelation 19. I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. The one sitting on it is called faithful and true. And what you see here is that truth is not just this sort of conceptual idea, but as we go down the list here, we're moving into almost more of a relational sense. And that Jesus is true. It's like newlyweds promise to each other, I will be true to you. I will be faithful. There's a faithfulness, a personal relational faithfulness that is part of the definition of biblical truth. So with those things in mind, let's ask a few more questions. And let's reread again John 18:37, where Jesus says this, for this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Jesus came to bear witness to the truth, to proclaim the truth. And everyone who is of the truth, is on the side of truth, listens to my voice. So, what does it mean to be of the truth? If you're of the truth, what does that really mean? Well, first, it means to submit yourself to a truth that is outside of yourself. And I think this is so key. As we just saw, approaches to truth that were really at their core self-centered. Even if they were veiled, that self-centeredness was veiled. They were really just about my own truth. Being of the truth means I am submitting myself to the truth, and it's outside of myself. And this is so countercultural. This is against so much of what we are taught, what we imbibe in this world. But it's not about us. It's not about my truth. No, it's about offering myself to the truth, submitting myself to it. And you know, this is hard. This is hard even for us as Christians. It's hard in our approach to the Bible. You know, sometimes we approach the Bible and we come across passages that are maybe a challenge for us. And we have to ask ourselves, am I going to submit myself to this truth? Or am I going to maintain what I believe is true and I'm going to conform the Bible to my version of truth? But being of the truth means to submit myself to truth outside of myself. But second, and this is key, and this is really what we want to get to this week. So it means to understand the truth is a person. A truth is a person. Again, it's not just a philosophical concept. But when you see the Bible describe truth, it takes this relational flavor, which is why Jesus can say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Okay, he is the truth. And again, it's so ironic that Pilate was standing before the truth. He said, what is truth? When truth was right there. And I think Jesus was even inviting him to explore that. You know, John records this dialogue between Pilate and Jesus, and Jesus is asking him questions. Okay, do you think that, or have you just been told that? Jesus is gauging where Pilate is at, but Pilate's not there. And he had the truth right in front of him, but he turned. But I think it's so important to understand that the truth really is a faithful person that's good, that's authentic, that's genuine, that's true. We think of truth, we naturally think of truth as oppressive and enslaving. Okay, truth we associate with this ugly dogmatism. It's just boundaries on my life. And it feels so freeing to, along with Pilate, say, what is truth? But it's not freeing. When we cast off any objective standard of truth, we are just floating in a sea without a rudder. And we're just getting tossed back and forth. And we so need something solid to stand on. And what's solid is not just, again, a concept, but a person. And when we submit ourselves and say, Jesus, you are the truth, I will follow you. Even when it's hard and even when I'm not quite sure what's happening, what's going on, and I'm struggling with these different ideas, as I submit myself to you, I find this stability. I find this freedom. I find this life, and I find relationship, because truth is relational. And we all want that. That's what we all want. Band, why don't you come on back up as I share one final verse. Remember, John, in his gospel and in all of his writings, he emphasizes truth. Truth. Well, there's one other verse that I think is a pretty famous one, and that's in John chapter 8, verse 31 and 32. It says, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And Jesus is inviting, he's saying, if you abide in me, remember, that's our theme. I'm going to stick that in here at the end. That's our theme for this fall, is abiding in Jesus. And when we connect relationally to the ultimate truth, then we know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Again, there's freedom. We are told in 1,000 different ways, truth is enslaving. It just provides unnecessary boundaries. We need to be free to think and feel ourselves under our own direction. But oh no. No, having a relationship with the ultimate good, the true faithful one, that's where freedom is. Yeah, the truth will set you free. And that provides us freedom and stability and something strong to stand on.